Good evening, and welcome to Art World Innovators, exploring stories of innovation in the art world. I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and you're listening to UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba. Our guest this evening is Judy Singer, Canadian-born artist, professor, freelance lecturer, private art instructor, and workshop leader practicing in Toronto. In 1974, towards the end of her fourth year at York University's Fine Arts program, Judy Singer was discovered by the late Jack Pollock, one of Toronto's foremost gallery owners of the times. From this first show at the Pollock Gallery, she has gone on to participate in many solo and group exhibits across Canada and the United States. Judy was highly recognized and selected in 1982 to represent Canada at the Carnegie International in Pittsburgh. In 2006, she was inducted into the Royal Canadian Academy of Arts. Over the years, she has forged strong collaborative relationships with many luminaries in the art world, fellow artists such as Sir Anthony Carroll, Helen Frankenthaler, and Larry Poons, who critiqued her work at the Triangle Workshop in 1983, as well as other prominent critics Ken Carpenter, the late Clement Greenberg, and Joan Murray, who have all been regular visitors to her studio. Judy Singer also taught painting, drawing, and art history at York University from 1976 to 2005. She continues to impart her passion for art through her lectures and workshops. Welcome to Art World Innovators, and thank you for joining us this evening.
Oh, thank you for calling.
As a young artist, you were fortunate that your talents were discovered early by the late Jack Pollock, who exhibited your works in his established Toronto gallery. How might this experience have set your future course?
Well, it gave me a lot of clarity. I mean, I knew that I did want to be an artist, but I didn't really give thought to how that was going to happen. And when Jack Pollock approached me and gave me my first show while I was still in my final year at York, it gave me a lot of clarity. And so as soon as I graduated from York University, I looked for a studio, and within the month after graduating, I had found a studio, and I had that studio for 10 and a half years. So basically, I've had to find ways to support myself, because even though my work was selling, I still had to make some money. So I had all kinds of odd jobs, waitressing and painting designs on women's clothing, and I started teaching also a couple of years later in 1976. So I really didn't go through the period of should I or shouldn't I. I had proof and support that, yes, this is what I want and need to be doing.
You also studied and practiced art at a remarkable and exciting period of artistic development in Canada and globally. Can you tell us more about your experience during those years with such renowned artists as the late Sir Anthony Carroll and the critic Clement Greenberg?
Well, I was very fortunate that I knew people in the art world who were friendly with all these people, and I often had studio visits by some of these people, or I went to a workshop where I met, for instance, Helen Frankenthaler and Sir Anthony Carroll. And so these were people who were senior artists in their careers, and they were very interested in supporting younger artists and looking at their work. Clement Greenberg was very good friends with the late Jack Bush. And after Jack Bush died, the Bush family had Clement Greenberg on his estate. So twice a year, Clement Greenberg would come up to Toronto when they had an estate meeting. And because Clem was so interested in the art scene in Canada, that when he was here, he made it his business to make sure that he went around to see all the younger artists' work. So that's how I got to meet Clement Greenberg and how I had a number of studio visits by him. It was very exciting. It was a very exciting time.
You have very intriguing titles for your paintings, and are there any narratives behind them?
Well, it's a funny thing about titles for me. I name my paintings after I've done them. So when I'm working, I don't have anything concrete in mind. When I'm painting, I try to just be this vessel through which the work comes through. But I am very interested in what I would call otherworldly things. And in the reading that I do for my pleasure, I often write down phrases and words that resonate with me so that when I'm finished painting and I've got a group of paintings and I have to name them, I open my notebooks where I have all these phrases and words. I look at the painting and then find the word or phrase that I think resonates well with the painting. So that's how I actually name them.
You also have a very vibrant color palette for your works. Can you tell us a bit more about your process and maybe with a description of a few of your pieces for our audience?
Well, color for me is primary. I use very bright colors, and in the newest series that I'm painting, I've been trying to work on making those colors even brighter. So I'm often using white to paint the areas around the colors so that the colors really, really pop out. And I really feel all color goes together. It's just how you put them together. So there isn't a color that's off limits for me. I never decide ahead of time what my color palette is going to be. I just start. And color for me is light. Light infuses color. It's what makes color what it is. And so I think of the color as moments and movements of light. I have a very painterly style. It's not hard edge. It's not geometric. It's pretty free form. I'm what I would call a very painterly artist, meaning that you will see the brushwork, you will see the brush strokes. For me, there is a lot of power, energy in a brush stroke, in one single stroke. I try to make those strokes really count when I'm painting.
As an artist and an art historian, you have an excellent combination of experience for teaching studio and art history classes that you would have at the university and for some of your workshops and presentations you do. Can you tell us about your career as a professor?
Teaching really solidified my philosophies about painting, my experiences about painting, and even being able to verbalize about painting. The verbal part is what you share with students and hopefully inspire them. Critiquing student work required me to be very alert to other people's work and to examine it closely. It's a combination of my experience of painting and also getting that experience across to inspire students, picking the right words to say, pointing to their work to show them what's good in it and where it could be improved, for instance. And it requires the knowledge of art history. So the more I taught, the better my grasp of art history was, how artists worked together and inspired each other. The teaching experience is wonderful. It illuminates my own work, and it forced me to really solidify my own philosophy about art and creativity. And I also had to do lots of research, and I still do research. I still challenge myself to be open to new things. It was an incredible experience.
So after the classes that you taught, what would you advise some of the young artists, and as they became more established, how would you advise them to approach the galleries and the museums to gain representation for their work and advance their career?
Well, that's a really hard one. The art world and the art market is a totally different place now than when I first started. And making art and creating art is really separate from the business part of the art world. I'm really not sure what I would tell young artists today. There are so many more galleries now, and what galleries show is very diverse, and it's very business-oriented, too. My biggest advice would be, if you want to be an artist, you really need to find some way to make a living through some other means than your art, because it's very, very challenging to find a dealer and to have the dealer sell your work. It's very competitive. The collectors today are more interested in the investment side of the art world, and that has really affected the art market today. I don't sound very positive, do I? These days, I'm more in my studio and more isolated from what's going on out there, and I'm very picky and choosy about the shows I go to now to see what interests me. I just think you find a way to do it. Go to the galleries, meet the dealers, get to know them, see where your art might fit. I actually would start in your hometown. Get your resume started. There are lots of things online as well today. Lots of shows you can enter. It's different than when I first started.
Do you have any exhibits coming up, or are you in the process of writing something for publication?
Well, yes, I have a show coming up in beginning of June. I have a solo exhibit in Toronto at the Nicola Rukai Gallery. I have been working on that for the past 6 months. So that is coming up, and we'll see where that takes me. I've also written and illustrated a children's book that will be available on Amazon at the beginning of February, and it's called What's a Woofie? And I've written it and illustrated it, so I'm looking forward to seeing where that goes.
Well, good luck with that. That sounds exciting and all the
Thank
rest.
Thank you. Yes, it's a little different for me.
And good luck on your exhibit coming up. And I'd like to thank you so much for sharing your insight and advice with our audience. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Oh, thank you so much. It's my pleasure as well. Thank you.
Thank you. That was Judy Singer, artist, professor, and writer, speaking with us from Toronto. For those of you just tuning in, you are listening to Art World Innovators on UMFM 101.5. Our guest this evening is Sébastien Aubin, an accomplished graphic artist working freelance in Montreal. He was born in Manitoba and raised in Outaouais, Quebec. Returning to his home province last year, Sébastien was the artist and Indigenous designer in residence here at the University of Manitoba's School of Art. He worked closely with the students, faculty, and Manitoba Indigenous communities, starting many conversations to develop relationships and exchange cultural knowledge, ideas, and creative practices. Last March, the School of Art Gallery held an exhibition of Sébastien's works created during his residency entitled No Brighter in the Middle. His artwork pertains to the past to help with the future. Welcome to Art World Innovators, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
If you look back to your childhood, what may have inspired you to become an artist?
Both my parents studied art. They didn't become artists when they were older, but what was fun is that I used to like taking found things in my house and installing them in my room in different ways. So I would take like soap boxes, you know, different kind of packages, and I would kind of nail them to my wall, and then my mom would come and critique me. So yes, art has been part of my a part of me and part of my childhood. Also a musician as an adolescent. I played drums till my, you know, mid-30s about, I would say. But I've always done artistic things. But I never really drew. So only at one point, these abstract forms. But that was it. Like, I still can't draw to save my life. But yeah, it's always been part of me.
And did your community and your cultural heritage play a significant role in your graphic designs and artistic expressions?
That's an interesting question, actually. In my design practice, I tried not to use things that romanticize or categorize our culture, I guess, or my community, we would say. I try to do things that are different. So I'm not the guy to call if you want, you know, a feather in there or a dream catcher or anything of those sorts, because I find that they have more of a spiritual connotation, more of a traditional connotation. I try to use things or take that as references in a way, but not use them literally in the work that I do. The only thing that I use a lot would be like circles, things that are very geometric and symmetric. I've always liked that, like balance within a space. As a graphic designer, I'm very much so inspired by all the great masters from Europe, you know, like Scandinavian design and different designers like that, I would say, and some in the States and some in Canada for sure. I've only come to notice that there is only a few indigenous graphic designers in the world now. It seems to be popping up a lot more. When I first started, there was maybe one more.
When you were at your exhibition opening of No Brighter in the Middle, you reflected on your experience, and one of the things you said was that you didn't realize before how much you missed people while working as an artist for the last 15 years. Can you tell us about being a resident artist in a university, about the conversations, ideas, and how this experience has contributed to your artistic development along with some of the other influences you just mentioned?
I would say that for about 10, 15 years, I've been only working with maybe like a small group of people. Or if I do have clients and contracts, the way that it works is that sometimes they're all over Canada, so I don't necessarily meet them face to face. I've been a freelancer for about 10, 15 years. So I really miss the fact that being with people actually makes you mentally grow. I think I was a little bit stagnant, and the residency as a whole, sharing with the students and the professors and the faculty, everybody that was there and within the community, actually expanded my mind a little bit, made me realize that maybe I was like too comfortable where I was. Not meaning that I was, not in regards to I know what I'm doing, I don't need to go anywhere else kind of thing, but it was more so that the students there, just some of them, I don't think that they know, but even talking to them for about 5 minutes just completely blew my mind. I met astrophysicists, I met people that were in biology that did different things, mathematics, archivists as well, and musicians. So I tried to work with as many different people as I could, and that made me grow a lot to the point where I feel that working for maybe somebody else, like let's say working as a graphic design job, I don't know if I could be able to handle that, but I want to go back to school. So I applied for a master's degree, and I got accepted. I'm just going through the steps and the motions of, you know, doing all that administrative stuff. The community has a really big importance. It always had, but I was in my own little bubble working at my desk and doing my own art. But now the fact that, you know, putting myself out there and talking to people really made me notice that I have a lot to learn. And that's what has really been pushing me, is to study more, figure things out. Yeah, I really find that interesting. And my approach has changed a little bit when I see art and how I do things. It's been really, really good. And I wouldn't say I'm wise, but I'm a little bit wiser now because of that 6 months experience for sure.
Excellent. And so when you're going into a master's degree, will you be focusing more on your artistic practice more so than, say, graphic design?
What's interesting about the master's in design is it's actually quite broad. So it's not like I'm concentrating like on design. I don't know what else I could do in design. Like I've done pretty much touched everything that comes to that. What I'd like to do is use a cresyllabic font that I will be designing, and which would be a monospace, and I would actually try and code computers and different kinds of things and see how they react to it, see what happens. I know that the Cherokees, I think, have tried to do it, or they've done it. I'm not sure, but I'm studying it a lot more. I find that interesting that maybe like these things that help, even if a cresyllabic font were actually invented to get indigenous people to convert indigenous people to Christianity and religion, I'm taking it back and using it as a tool to recode things that are very much people use every day. Maybe there's another conversation that will happen within that. And I'm also very interested with binary codes like zeros and ones. I find them to look a little bit like wampum belts, and that's how you code. That's the basic language. That would be the basic language, I would say, for computers. So, and then I'll be learning things because I don't know too much about computers and technology as well. I'm very much so a print designer. I make things more with my hands, I would say, than with... That'll be interesting for sure.
In No Brighter in the Middle, mm-hmm. you used a number of interesting found materials to compose your sculptures. Can you tell us about the sort of materials you used and where you found them and what they may signify for you?
Oh, for sure. Like if you look at unnatural, those are the moose antlers. Those were moose antlers. Like, it's a kind of a funny story. I was in on my reserve at the dump, thinking of finding found materials like I used to do in my parents' house or the house that I grew up in, and use things and take them back and put them somewhere else. And I thought that was kind of interesting. With the moose antlers, there's just the guy at the dump giving them to me. But, you know, when somebody gives you something in our culture, you have to give tobacco. So I had to go back I didn't have tobacco, so I went back and gave him tobacco. He says, you can do something with this. You know, you're an artist, you're inventive. So it's like, I felt obligated a little bit. And he was an older man, so it was interesting. So I did actually use them. I found a person that shrink wraps, and he did it for me, because I tried to do it, but it was a big mess. And it also made me like do a little bit of collaboration. And this person was non-Indigenous, so we talked about it and how we found it and why I wanted to do it. And he thought it was quite interesting. So that's the story of that. And also to take it actually out of context completely and protect them. Maybe it's like protecting our culture, protecting our future, protecting the animals in a way. And plastic is something that comes from a natural state, but very unnatural at the end. You know, sometimes it's oil-based. If you look at breathing the same air, that is just an idea that I've had for about 2-3 years. I found a contractor, a supplier that had the capacity of doing it. We collaborated together again. And then, you know, again, it's me telling a story to them and saying, you know, I find that this is something that we see in all institutions across Canada or the world, you know, I guess in developed countries. More so, and it's all, I find that it's something where the air circulates from one room to the next, so it's actually shared. So if you would be like at the University of Manitoba, if you would be like having a meeting with an astrophysicist that's there, or like the people would be talking about science in the other room, they were talking about literature, they're actually breathing the same air, maybe possibly breathing the same energy, and has a sense of community. And the one is taller, one is smaller, so that was prefabricated. After that, would we look at each other in the mirrors that we traded? So I thought that was interesting. Those were the high-density polyethylene, sorry if I'm saying it wrong, and mylar. And what I liked about that is that there was a mirror to it. And then, you know, they say, some people say that we traded this country with mirrors and trinkets and different things. So if we would look at that again, ourselves in those mirrors that we traded, those, thought that was interesting. And again, I put like I did a Cree syllabic font for that. And you would see what it would say in the mirror. So it was reversed if you didn't use the mirror. And this notion of something else in the water, like underneath the water and over the water, you know, there's a deeper meaning to things. Shedding some light. That was an inkjet print with Tyvek. I thought that was interesting. If you would take, like, Tyvek is used a lot on to make houses, and some people on reserves don't finish their houses, but they have Tyvek, and you would see it. And I thought that was kind of interesting in a way, as if we would take this and take a font and put it around the house, or we're wrapping ourselves in our language and our culture and this, all these things that relate to our past and our future and our present. So I thought that was pretty interesting. The winter gloves, that was something that I had to give back to the community. Those are the Pass It On, that tall piece made of paint and MDF. I went to visit Silver Company, I think it's called, and they make the garbage mitts. So I bought garbage mitts. They were too big, so I had to go trade them there because they didn't have my size at the store. And what I found interesting about that was I just asked, while I was there in the shop, if she would like to give them out and do like a kind of community outreach with the University of Manitoba, so that the people would actually, well, we would put them back into the community. So I actually contacted the Bear Patrol, I think they're called, in the North End. And so they make little pack, like little bundles, little packages. And so they'll be putting these gloves in the packages, actually. So that was to give back to the community, to warm up your hands. And people that are like, that maybe have bought these mitts, these white mitts that are non-Indigenous and actually bought them, they'll be wearing the same thing in a way. So I find that relation interesting as well. The animation, well, those are drawings that I've been doing. So black and white animation, has a little bit of color. Those are drawings that I've been doing as an adolescent, and I just find that I had to, you know, reappropriate them and renegotiate them and put them into context and see how I feel about them now. So I did, and I made an animation. I collaborated with Simon Guibord and Rachel Monnier. Rachel Monnier did the Adobe After Effects. Simon Guibord mastered the piano and did a little bit of like tweaking to it, I would say. I recorded for about an hour and 20 minutes the same song, the same thing for that I played for a minute and 20 seconds. I did for an hour and 20 minutes, almost the length of the piece. We made it shorter. Take was just an embossing on paper of what you saw in the animation. That was just to give again to students, faculty, whoever came to the show. I just thought that I had to give back because a lot was given to me. And then Laudation, the vacuum forming, well, that was at the dump on my reserve, Wapaskwayak Cree Nation. And I just gathered shoes, and the shoes were like in good shape, but there was only missing one. They weren't in pairs, so I thought that was kind of funny. So I retook them, I reformed them, and I finally kind of, and I used one of my shoes that I actually bought in Paris, France. So it's as if I walked back to where maybe, you know, the colonialists went, and we gathered and we all shared the same energy. So I thought that was kind of interesting. I had fun doing that as well, and I guess it's like called particle board or like chipboard to make the frames. All in all, it was just like a happy, community, positive-oriented overall concept that I tried to do as much as possible, like sharing. You see so much pain and distraught when it comes to art and everything that you see on the news. I just wanted to do something positive to show that we're, you know, positive thinkers and moving forward. You know, every time we seem to gather together, it's for when it's like pain and misery, which is fine. But sometimes I think we need to celebrate the positivity that happens within the community as well.
Well, your works are certainly very positive and very innovative, and we'll be looking forward to a lot more new ones during and after you get your degree.
Yeah.
I want to thank you very much for being on our show, and we appreciate you taking the time to be with us. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you very much, Susan. Thank you very much.
Thank you. That was graphic artist Sebastian Aubin speaking to us from his studio in Montreal, Canada. I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and we thank you for listening to Art World Innovators here on UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba. Join us again next Wednesday from 5:30 to 6 p.m. for more on today's innovators in the art world.